Talk Podcast. I'm co-host Scott McLeod, the associate publisher of Flagstick Golf Magazine, Ontario Golf News, and a PGA of Canada professional. My co-host, Stefan Tiedorf, is away this week. He's off in Toronto. Maybe he's on a secret mission for his beloved Toronto Maple Leafs, maybe getting them sorted out. I'm not sure, but hopefully he's back soon and we're talking more golf. In the meantime, we've got a special guest this week. We're going to talk about indoor golf. We're getting to the end of the outdoor golf season for a lot of you, especially those in Canada, northeastern and northern U.S., and other parts of the world as well. So we thought we'd kind of focus in on that topic, and you know, we will talk about more of it during this off season as well. But let's get started this week with our special guest. It's Derek McDonald. He's the Academy Manager at the Royal Ottawa Golf Club in the National Capital Region of Canada. And we're going to chat with him a little bit about indoor instruction, things that you can do to improve your game in the off season. And I think you'll really enjoy this conversation, and let's get to it. As I said, Derek McDonald, who's the Golf Academy Manager at the Royal Ottawa Golf Club. Good friend, longtime friend. How are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. Obviously, I see you there in your bay. Obviously, our listeners can't see that, but you're teaching today, I assume.
I am, yeah. We've got some crazy golfers that want to keep going and keep learning. So, yeah, over the next few days, I'm still pretty busy.
I guess that's not a bad thing. Overall, it's been a great season, I'm sure.
It's been a fantastic season. I can actually say it's been my best year personally as a golf professional. So I've truly enjoyed my time here at the Royal in the first year, and looking forward to much, much more down the road.
Well, let's get to a little general intro here for you. Some people may be not familiar with you. Obviously, we have listeners in various countries and so forth. But maybe a quick synopsis on who Derek McDonald is, besides a nominee for Teacher of the Year in the PGA of Ottawa, in the PGA of Canada, and a former Junior Leader of the Year. But what's your background and how'd you get into the game? And let's keep it short, because I know you can go long on that. But, what's been your affinity, I guess, from the coaching side of things involved with the PGA?
Yeah, so I've been a PGA member now for, I guess, almost 16 years now, 15, 16 years. Grew up playing competitive golf, and, people always ask, did you ever think about playing? And I was like, I was very realistic at a young age, and I kind of understood where I was, and yeah, I could play golf and I was decent, but I also knew I was never going to be a PGA Tour player, but was fascinated more with my time with my golf coach back when I was a junior than probably I was even competing. So I kind of knew since I was like 15 years old that this was the route I was going to go towards, and I wanted to become a teacher and a coach. Kind of always had that in my mind, and my parents just said that if I want to go that route, I had to finish school first. Smart decision on their part to get me go to university, and but after that, kind of jumped into it, and here we are. So I've been a head golf professional for, I guess, 10-11 years. My passion was always to be out on the teaching deck and on the course with students. Luckily, I'm in a position now where I've moved from the Marches Golf Club, where I was the head golf professional at, to the Royal Ottawa, where I'm now the academy manager. And very, very fortunate for this opportunity, where I can truly say for the first time in my life, I get to just do what I love. And I get to come in here and teach every day, and instruct and coach, and travel with the juniors and my competitive players. And it's a blast.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we got to know each other well over the years through golf and involved with the Golf Ontario player development program. And we brought that to the golf club that you were at the time. And, you were part of that program. And we've been sort of kindred spirits since then, as far as traveling all over the place, doing all sorts of education things and so forth. And I've certainly enjoyed it. And I think people will enjoy your insight too. And, our focus really today is going to be, indoor instruction. We're getting to that time of year. Where a lot of people, obviously in Canada, northern US, and other parts of the world, of course, their outdoor golf season is over. So indoor instruction now has become a big thing, much bigger than probably, you know, when you were growing up and when I was growing up, for sure. Why don't you tell us maybe a little bit about what you've seen as far as the evolution of indoor instruction in your experience in the golf world?
Yeah. So, I mean, I started working indoors with my coach back when I was 14. And, you know, back then we just hit into a net, had some video. And so we could analyze through that really good quality of video back then.
It seems kind of primitive now, doesn't it?
But, I mean, that's all it kind of was back then. Had some video banging balls into a net. And, then I guess I could say my evolution with it was I had my own winter academy back when I was the head pro in Brockville at the Brockville Country Club. Started it up there, kind of not much different for the first year. Was really just that idea of, okay, I used some video and we're inside hitting into nets, had a putting green, but then
what were you shooting video on at the time? I mean, you know, it's not like you had some of the iPhones that are 240 frames a second now that you can make use of, but do you recall what you were using at the time?
I think I was just using the video cameras back then, just okay. the camcorders.
Nice.
I think that's all I still had at that point.
Some 20 yeah. pound monster camcorder that was.
Yeah, like it was just a handheld one, but it was nothing special. And then, you know, use the phone as well. But even the quality of the camera back then, the phone was terrible too. So I just started doing that the first year. But then that's when I really started to dive much deeper into understanding truly what's going on, and needed to provide not only a better experience for the students, but I really just wanted to know more about what was going on. And so that's when I sort of dove into purchasing a TrackMan. That was 10 years ago now, I guess. And that was kind of the first step. And from there, it's kind of exploded a bit on me and gone from, you know, just having the TrackMan indoors, which was great. At least we had something that we could measure with. But then moving into pressure mats and some 3D motion capture and Sam Putt Lab now. And so kind of just blew up on me, you know, really quickly. It was a bit of a risk that it was the most amount of money I had ever spent on on a particular item. I was young and but luckily I had a club to support me, and truly I'll always be thankful for that, because that's really what kick started a lot for me. And now I'm at this facility where I'm extremely lucky, and we have many tools here to use. So now we can truly get an idea of what is happening indoors in the winter. I always tell people this, I probably ruined more players than I helped back in the day when we were just hitting balls into a net indoors in the winter, and sort of kind of going off of a style that I prefer and all that kind of
look.
Stuff as opposed to a look that's all it really was. Whereas now it's like, you know, I have never talked more about feels more of my life than I have with you know, having an understanding of what truly is happening to get the player just to move better dynamically for them, as opposed to a look or a style. I mean, we all still have our preferences, but in the end, it's about the motion, not the style. So,
yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, objectively kind of looking at it, if we look back, you know, 20 years, a lot of the indoor stuff that was maybe done back then was, it was more exercise and people just, you know, the ability to be inside and just kind of beat balls. And, you know, they might've got a few surprises in April when all of a sudden they went back outside and went, oh boy, well, what did I do over the wintertime?
Well, that's a great point. You know, still to this day, because I mean, a lot of this technology is obviously very new to golfers. I mean, it's just new to some instructors and stuff as well, but it's very new to just the average golfer. So I have like people that come to me every winter and they're like, oh, I hope whatever I'm seeing up on the, you know, the screen, I hope that's what's going to happen when I'm outdoors. And I'm like, look, you know, this technology that we're using is very accurate. And I can confidently and comfortably make any change in the winter now indoors and know what was going to happen once we do get outdoors. And, you know, I always love that first couple of days in the spring after they've been indoors working on their game. And they come running up to me and going, oh my God, the ball flight is so good. Like, it's like exactly what we were saying. I was like, yes, of course. Like, I knew that was going to be the case. It wasn't going to be like some, you know, the opposite of what we've been seeing. Like, yes, it's not a surprise. It's this is what we've been working on. But for them, it is a surprise. They're just like, oh, it was, you know, I'm hitting into a screen. Is this really what's going to happen when I get out there? But it is. So,
yeah. Do you think that's really, you know, kind of what has pushed indoor golf? I mean, obviously we had situations in the last little while with pandemic and stuff that a lot of people were inside, but, you know, prior to that, people were really starting to, well, we'll say trust more and be involved more with training. Do you think it's because they're more interested in training or do you think it's because they, there's more tools and things that are out there now that maybe they trust a little bit and they know it's going to actually make a difference?
Yeah. I mean, the education to the average golfer out there is getting better. And, you know, people are talking a lot more. And I think they're starting to gain that trust as to, you know, how good the technologies are these days. So I think there's a little bit of, yes, okay, like during this, you know, COVID time and the pandemic, you know, there wasn't a whole lot to do. So I think that just definitely brought some people in to say, well, I can still go in and hit balls. So it gives me something to do. But on top of that, I think more importantly is just, you know, people realizing that there is such a huge benefit now. I mean, to practicing indoors in the winter, and we have to face the fact that we live in Canada and, you know, we only have so much time outdoors. We got to make the use of our time in the winter the best we can. And, you know, if you're at a facility where they have use of these tools, you can really do some, you know, deep development in your game and in your mechanics or whatever you want to look at it. And you can really make good use of that time in those 6 months indoors and not just sort of pack it away, show up on, you know, May 1st and go at it again. So I think people are just more comfortable now with what technologies are available and what we can do indoors. And they've seen so many other people that have maybe jumped on that bandwagon a little bit earlier. And seeing the benefits to their games. And so they're like, wow, okay, it's helping them. Like, I really need to jump on this myself.
Well, let's talk about that in relationship to the sort of the training cycle. A lot of people are obviously looking at, if they look at golf as a year-round sport, a lot of people are sort of flipping and realizing, understanding that maybe they can do something a little bit different in the off season than what they need to be doing while they're trying to compete and score their best golf. Maybe you can address that a little bit of what the advantages might be to be working on it, you know, kind of this time of year as a performance cycle where you're trying to work on bigger pieces in your game. And then, you know, maybe during the season, just kind of fine tuning things and not having to worry about those big differences and taking those to the golf course and trusting those.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. That's kind of what I tell everyone that comes and works with me in the winter is I'm like, okay, this is a good opportunity for us when we can sort of assess where your game's at, where are the weaknesses, you know, not just, you know, whether we're talking about driving or wedges, but just actually in the mechanics of what's producing their shot patterns and say, look, this is a great time for us to now work on these mechanics and change these. And you're not worried about scoring. You're truly just working on the patterns, trying to develop different patterns and maybe trying to beat out some of those old patterns out of there, you know, and with that repetition, that kind of will come in time. You know, we all have our tendencies. I still have mine. I remember the first time I ever saw my swing on video and I still have this one tendency that I saw. It was so distinct. I still have to this day and I'm still trying to beat that out of me. But it is a good time for them to do that. They're not worried about going out there and shooting a score. Whereas in the summer, I'm not going to make any major change with a student in the summer, unless for some reason they're just adamant that that has to happen. But I mean, I would say that's a complete rarity. I'm really just looking at saying, okay, what can we do to have a little bit more control in the summertime? Let's kind of, you know, not necessarily band-aid some things, but let's just be able to get the ball around without having to worry about all these changes in your swing. And even that, I mean, I even hate trying to say that. People are always so worried that when they come and see you, you're going to, you know, overhaul their swing. And I'm going to tell everyone, I've never overhauled a swing in my life. You know, it's just about making little tweaks here and there. And sure, over the course of time, it might look like there's been changes from the beginning, but it's not something that anyone would be able to see, you know, on a month to month basis per se. But it is a great time where in the indoors where you're not worried about the result. People are so much more committed, I find, to working on those patterns because they're not trying to hit it between, you know, tree lines or out of bounds on the right and the water on the left. And all of a sudden it doesn't work when they get out there if this is the summertime. And so then they just give up on that pattern altogether. Indoors, they tend to stay on the pathway a little bit longer and they're more committed to it.
Yeah. Committed, I guess, is probably the great word there. It's really easy, as people say, you know, it's all great in a fight until you get punched in the face. Right. And that amounts to the golf course as well. You know, it all seems well and good when you're trying to do something, but all of a sudden you hit that ball out of bounds and kind of revert back to your tendencies more than anything. What in particular do you think, you know, golfers should really be focused on in the off season? Are there particular components of their game that they should work on, shouldn't work on? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's a lot to that, I would say. I mean, number one is, like, I would say every time, or like right around this time of year when we start going indoors, is like, okay, let's kind of assess the summer and let's see where were we at, where are some strengths and weaknesses.
So that's always your starting point, is right there. You got to start with that sort of assessment instead of just going in there and patching more things on it. You got to have a starting point.
Yeah. So it's a great time where, like, with my competitive players, where, you know, we'll look at some of the the stats over the year and say, okay, well, what were you good at? Like, say, strokes gains, you know, if we can look at some of those stats and say, okay, what's your strengths and weaknesses? Where do we want to get to in the 6 months? Where do we want to see things improve and kind of move towards? So we always just start with sort of like reassessing that and then setting some goals from there. I think that's always, like, kind of that, to me, that has to be the starting point. Otherwise, like, how do you put a plan together whatsoever? Yeah. So I'm always starting with that. You know, it's also like, you know, in the off season, like, this isn't necessarily with golf instruction, but it has to do with their golf game. It's like, it's a great time to start focusing maybe on some strength and conditioning. Because especially if someone's not used to, say, you know, hitting the gym a little bit, they're going to be obviously a little bit stiff at first. So it's a great time where they can still, you know, not have to worry about scoring and their body's adjusting. And so if they're working on maybe some speed training and trying to get stronger, trying to get faster, I think it's a great time for that as well. I mean, other than that, I'm really just going to start, taking a look at, okay, what are some of the mechanics that are currently happening? What are some of their tendencies that are currently going on in their swing? And then saying, okay, what do we need to tackle first? And we sort of just start putting a plan together as to, okay, here's where you're currently at. I don't know. Let's take an average golfer, for example. Forget, like, never mind the competitive players right now. But, if, you know, take the average golfer who's, you know, been hitting a splice their whole, you know, their whole life kind of thing. Yeah. And they're wanting to work on that. Well, okay. Now it's like, okay, here's the patterns that you do. Get them to understand, educate them a little bit as to, you know, why the ball is doing what it's doing. And then make them sort of understand the direction we need to go into to change, whether it's the path. Well, you know, but then it's maybe not just about the path. Maybe their face is wide open throughout their swing and that's creating their path going over the top. So, you know, it's really just sort of going at it from there and say, okay, here's what we're going to tackle first. Boom. You know, we want to change that path. Okay, sure. We want to change the path, but let's tackle the face first. Let's get that face a little more under control to incentivize them a little bit more to come from the inside, if that's the case. There's just so much you can go in this direction.
I mean, you mentioned something there that I think is really important. And you talked about the education component and the fact that, you know, you're educating the golfer and you're trying to give them valid reasoning of why things happen so that they can make the change. And that's an important aspect that I think maybe a lot of people don't think about. They think maybe they're just going to show up and they're going to get corrections rather than actually learning what's going to happen and giving them a foundation to work on.
I tell everyone that comes in to see me, literally, and maybe not a straight beginner, but anyone who has any golf experience at all, any coordination with a club, the first thing I go over with them is the ball flight laws and then make them understand that. I know it's going to, I tell everyone, a lot of the members here attest to this, is that I tell them, I'm like, the first lesson sucks. I'm like, it's a lot of me talking. And I always tell them, like, I don't normally talk that much in a lesson, but the first one, because of the tools we're using, and I want our brains to be on the same page and the lingo to be in the same direction, that I go over the ball flight laws with them. And it's literally out of that, let's say, an hour long. It's probably 35 minutes of me talking. And, but they love it. Every single person I've ever gone through with is like, it just opens their eyes a lot of time going, yeah. Wow. Like I had no clue. The nice thing about it, I tell them like, you need this understanding so that when we are starting to go and work on things that, and we start seeing some of the data pop up, they have an understanding of what is actually coming up on the screen and what does that mean? And all of a sudden then they start to go, oh, okay. So there's the ball flight that I just hit. Here's what, let's just say, for example, my path going to the left as a right-handed golfer. I'm like, oh, okay. So then we start shifting things around. And I tell everyone, I'm like, if they have any coordination with the club, if I can't change their ball flight in 5 minutes, I won't charge them.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to say they own the ball flight in 5 minutes. But
they're renting
but
it.
If I can, exactly. Until they change those patterns for good. But I tell them all the time, if I can't change their ball flight in 5 minutes, I won't charge them. And that's not because it's their fault. It's my fault. They should leave me right then and there. Now, the only reason I say that is I can set up constraints when people are in front of me and I can force them to do certain things. And then we can see changes. And that's the nice thing about the indoors is these feels sometimes are really exaggerated and they're just like, there's no way that this can be right. But when you all of a sudden start to see how the data is moving around, the measurements are moving around, the ball flights are changing. Because I guess the number one analogy I always give people, when you start changing a motor pattern, that's really all, like when we swing a golf club, it's just a motor pattern, a motor skill. Same thing when you write your name, you know, with a pen and a piece of paper, it's just a motor pattern. Well, when you start making changes, I tell everyone, three things happen to everyone that's out there. Number one, you're going to think a lot. Right. You can't shut that off. It's just always going to be, you're going to constantly be, people are always coming to me like, oh, I just got to stop thinking over the bottom. Like, well, first of all, that's never going to happen. Like you're always going to be thinking. The second thing, when you start making some changes, it feels weird. It doesn't feel comfortable. And that's just because it's different. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means it's different. And then the third thing is at first, there's literally no consistency amongst each shot at first. Or if you're, you know, I go back to the using the analogy of writing your name on a piece of paper. If you write your name on a piece of paper with your opposite hand, those three things happen. You're going to think your hand's not used to moving in that pattern. So you have to kind of think and it's slower as you're doing it.
Yeah. Two, you're consciously incompetent to start with. And obviously totally. You're working towards being unconsciously competent, which is the 100%. Opposite end. Yeah.
100%. Two, it's going to feel weird. It's going to feel uncomfortable. And three, I did this to a member here at the beginning of this year. It was actually quite hilarious because he wasn't believing what I was saying. So I made him write his name three times on a piece of paper with his wrong hand. And sure enough, it was taking forever because he was thinking, he had to go slow. He was thinking forever. And I finally had to tell him, like, hey, we only have an hour here. Like, we got to get going. The second thing, he said it out loud. I didn't even say a word. He's just like, oh my God, this feels so weird. I'm like, of course, because it's you're not used to it. And then the third thing, and this is the funny part, those first three names didn't even remotely look the same. And I couldn't even make out a single letter on the first name that he wrote down. And he only has four letters in his name. And I couldn't even make out a single letter. Now, as the second and third, it didn't get a lot better, but you could at least start making out some letters. It's no different with these patterns that we're changing in golf. We're changing these motor patterns inside or outdoors. And those same three things happen where once we get indoors, again, because of those drastic changes, and yes, it's going to feel weird. Yes, they're going to think a lot. And at first, the consistency of the ball flight's not going to be there. Maybe their contact goes at first because maybe they come more from the inside and their low point happens too early, whatever it may be. But in time, all that starts to sort of come in sync. It starts to feel more normal. I never say natural because I don't think anything in the golf swing is very natural.
No.
they don't have to think as much. You know, it's kind of starts to become a little bit more automatic. And then the consistency comes because their strike gets a little better, their ball flight gets tighter, whatever it may be, or just changes. And those three things like are always going to be happening to every single person that comes in here and starts making these.
Yeah, we should say here too that even for experienced golfers, because I can remember a round you and I were playing down near Syracuse and we were talking about feels and, you know, it was the very first hole and you felt you had to swing way far in one direction in order to get a normal ball flight. And it took some time to adjust that. So people should understand that this is not just for, you know, beginning golfers or emerging golfers or, you know, this is, you know, guys who are golf professionals that train with it all the time. And that correlation between the feel and the result just really takes time to, you know, kind of tune it. And that's the important part as well for having devices like a TrackMan from a field perspective is that you can correlate what you're doing to the numbers that you see there and then start to trust that feel and know that's the right feel.
And that's the important thing about coming indoors, I find, because now they have time to incorporate some of those feels and they can experiment a little bit. I tell everyone, like, when they leave me, they're always kind of worried and saying, well, I don't want to go practice because you're not going to be there. I don't want to be doing the wrong things. I'm like, it gives you time to experiment, sort of self-discover some things. Yeah. They could be doing everything wrong when I'm not around. They're still going to get better in the sense of their hand-eye coordination is going to get better. Yeah. I mean, in the end,
and sometimes really it's good to do the wrong thing in order to find the right thing. And I think people forget that they're so busy trying to find the perfect swing. They have to realize that there's variations of, you know, an effective golf swing, but they have to be able to have the freedom to explore that a little bit to make the, what they think are mistakes, but to make them functional as far as a golf swing is concerned.
Totally. And like, you know, playing, like you were just saying, like playing around with those feels, because it is going to feel weird. It is going to feel different. It is going to feel uncomfortable. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means it's different. And that's where a lot of people give up on some of these changes in the summertime, because things feel weird. They don't have the control of the ball flight at first, and their emotions get in the way when they're on the golf course, and they give up on it. And you see it all the time. If you do one-off lesson with somebody and they're not sort of sticking to a plan, they're just trying to come because they think it's going to be a quick fix, and then they just give up and they go right back to what they were doing, because these feels are drastic at times. Sometimes it's small, sometimes it's drastic.
And I guess that's a good point too, in talking about the routines and talking about the winter time and, you know, during the season as well. It's important that this becomes a routine. It's not something that's one time. I mean, the fact that, you know, you said it right away, you know, you're renting it until you kind of work on it. You don't own it. It is a long time to change a motor pattern, because again, you're just basically reprogramming your central nervous system. That takes time, you know, and that takes time to trust that as well. So, you know, when people are coming and looking for indoor instruction, obviously, you know, it's not a case of let's do one lesson and I'm good for the winter and I should be ready when I come in April. What do you see for most people? Or, and again, this is not recommended, you know, just based on, hey, I want to see you a million times so I can make a bunch of money. This is based on, you need to do this if you're going to train and be better. I mean, my daughter always has the best analogy when she talks about piano, and we talked about it years ago, and I remember her asking me, she was probably 8 at the time, why don't people go and have a piano lesson every single week and they're working at, you know, at getting better, yet people expect to go to have one golf lesson and expect to be great instantly. You know, there's a different expectation, I guess, and people are looking for that fix. So, you know, what should they be doing kind of in the wintertime, maybe from a routine?
Yeah. So I would say the ones that come to me that are, you know, they sign up for seasonal packages, whether that's a winter seasonal or a summer seasonal. I pretty much see them once a week. So that's part of the offerings. Now, that's when they come and see me. But I mean, those people are obviously committed to changing. And they're also, like, in the winter, they're probably putting in, I mean, honestly, some of my students will come almost every day and hit balls. You know, I would say on average, the majority of them will probably see me once a week and then come and hit balls 2 or 3 times on top of that, to be able to sort of work towards changing those patterns. And again, that some of that self-discovery, some of that experimenting with it. And then I'm also able to just pop my head in when they're around and just sort of say, yep, that's what we're doing. It's not necessarily a formal lesson or anything, but it allows me to keep an eye on them a lot more. So I would definitely say that. I mean, it really depends on what the person's trying to get out of. I mean, I guess my number one example would be, I had a student come to me and say, okay, Derek, I've never broken 100 in my life. He's like, I play with my buddies 3 times a week, once during the week, twice on weekends. And every time we add up the scorecard at the end, he's like, I'm in the 80s. He's like, I've never broken 100. He's like, they're giving me, you know, 6-foot putts and just whacking them back to me. He's like, we drop balls all over the place. He's like, I can tell you I've never broke 100. So he came to me in the winter. We set up a game plan. Kudos to him. He came minimum each time. He came 4 days a week to hit balls. Now, he saw me probably, like I said, about once a week for a lesson. And then he hit balls 3 times on top of that minimum. And he went out that summer, and I'll never forget it. He played in the club championships. So everything in the hole, playing by the rules of golf, and broke 90 both times, shot 88, 86, you know, from somebody who's technically never broken 100. And there's some of the benefits of, you know, the effort that he put in over the winter, making the changes, because I remember his path, the very first time I saw him, was 15 degrees left as a right-hander, the weakest, ugliest slice you've seen.
So to give people relevance, if they're not really familiar, what would be a path, and I know this, but you can answer it, what would be a path for a fader, for a tour player, for an example, what would they see as far as degrees left?
Yeah. Awesome. So if they're a fader, so if they're like, if they had a nice little fade, you're probably seeing a path left. It's somewhere between 2 to 4 degrees left, somewhere in that ballpark. So 15 degrees left is a lot. That's going to create a lot of curve. And it's, you know, because he's swiping across the ball so much, it's just like more, I call it like more of a glancing blow to the ball.
Right.
It's also not going anywhere. So, you know, he changed all that. And all of a sudden he started drawing the golf ball. It took the whole winter. I mean, that was a drastic change in a pattern. But working his butt off in the winter, we're able to measure things still. He went out there, boom, starts drawing, starts launching it way further than he ever has. Still to this day, I don't get to see him anymore. He's not in the town that I'm in now, but still messages me the odd time and says he's never enjoyed the game as much as he had since that time in the winter and going forward, just because the game is so much more enjoyable now for him. And that's just all from the hard work he put in from the winter indoors.
And I think that's a big lesson as well. I mean, there's a lot of people, you know, having been in the, you know, golf equipment business as well in the past, you know, I know a lot of people buy equipment more because it's hope more than anything. Obviously a good equipment is a good, you know, is an important aspect of how they play. But, you know, the investment that they can make, especially if you look at the cost of a driver or something now or irons or whatever, for the investment that they can make as far as coaching and put that money into it, they could probably gain that much more. And as you said, end up being much happier for a much longer time.
Oh, 100%. I mean, people have no issue spending $700 on a driver, but try and get them to spend that on some golf lessons. Now, you know, some of the educated golfers out there that maybe have done their research on and looked at the backgrounds of certain, you know, coaches or instructors that are out there, and they're confident because they know the results have happened through that person's hard work with a student before, and their understanding and knowledge. You know, there's a lot of people that are, you know, they're grinders. They will have no issues spending X amount of dollars to know that they can improve their game, and they will improve their game and enjoy the game that much more. And it's not just the average golfers too. You know, that the reason, you know, more than anything that I love having these technologies indoors is when you're working with a competitive player, you're working with somebody who's got goals and aspirations. You better be right with them. You know, when you're making any suggestion or change, with their techniques, because you can ruin a golfer real quick, you know, giving them just the slightest of, you know, bad information.
Yeah.
So you know, that the nice thing about with these technologies that is measuring extremely accurately, that's how you can be so much more comfortable and confident. I tell her, those are my two words all the time for the winter. I'm super comfortable and super confident in any change I make with somebody. And I think they're always pleasantly surprised come springtime. So
yeah, people I think have to realize that, you know, things like eyeballs and even cameras sometimes will you know, give them a false sense of what's actually happening. Obviously, as coaches are more educated, they understand the limitations and the variations that can happen with those devices for sure. But, you know, we talk all the time about certain things, but even measuring in 3D, you can actually measure and see actually what's happening. You know, if you're looking at somebody's, you know, chest turn or their pelvis motion or whatever, when you can actually measure it and see it, it's not you just, you know, subjectively saying, oh yeah, it's much better. When the student can actually see that and the measurement change, much like TrackMan, if all of a sudden that big path changes there, they can actually see that. It's not you just you standing over going, yeah, that looks good. That looks much better.
Exactly. And, you know, you talk about, you know, those two things in particular, you know, then you start looking at even like, say, wrist angles. And when you start wanting to measure wrist angles, I mean, if you're looking at a 10 degree difference in wrist angles, for example, lead wrist at the top of the swing, you can't really even see 10 degrees on a camera. So all of a sudden now you have tools and devices that can measure these things, and it's it's quantifiable. It's it's now the student being able to see this and be like, oh, okay, it actually is changing. My wrist angles are different. My club face is now changing. Oh, all of a sudden my path is starting to change. Like, it's all interconnected that way. And it's just something that you gain the trust of the student a lot faster when you're able to measure and show them that some of this information you're feeding them is actually making a difference and making changes on the spot. You just gain their trust so much more. I mean, I tell people all the time. So when I'm in out here teaching, and let's call it outdoors for a second, and I watch their ball flight. I mean, I've seen so many shots on TrackMan in 10 years. It's absolutely ludicrous. And I can stand behind a golfer once I know their club head speed. And then I see ball flights, I can pretty much like call out what their path is going to be, what their face roughly was based on the starting direction. And I'm always within a degree. Like it's insane. Like people call me here. They're like, oh, you're like a human track man. Well, it's like, it's just through history, yeah. Right? Through experience of educated. Seeing ball flights. It's just educated. And my eye has been seeing so many shots. You can start spitting these things out left, right, and center. Now I will always choose to use the technology. There's not a lesson I have where I don't use the, for example, TrackMan in the background. You know, just because we always say, right? Like, well, why guess when you can measure? But it gains the trust of the student so much faster, I find. Yeah. And they're committed. As soon as they start seeing that change, and it's almost like, even if they didn't hit it well, and they just see the number change, they're just like, oh, okay, actually that was a better pattern. I need to figure out where the low point is, you know? But I've never stopped using it. That's
for sure. And people have to realize too, you know, the key component here is always the coach. I mean, the tools are the tools, and they allow you to do, you know, a lot of things faster. That's one of the great things. You're able to dive in and get to where you need to go much faster. But, you know, as we always say, you know, TrackMan's not a magic box, right?
It doesn't tell you what needs to change. It just tells you what happened.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And there's obviously lots of ways to get there based on all the different things that you do. And people have to realize their golf swings are, you know, their own individual puzzles. So, all right, you know what we're going to do here? There's a lot of great stuff that's in there. I really appreciate that. And I know you've got to teach in a little bit. So we've got some mailbag questions here. I'd love to go through with you and get your opinion on some of these, get your answers on these questions. I'm sure some of them are going to feel very familiar because, again, as we know in the golf world, a lot of people are dealing with the same issues and stuff all the time. So you ready to answer some mailbag questions?
Let's go for it.
All right, here we go. First one, I don't put a lot of spin on my wedge and they come out really low. I take big divots, but does not seem to help. Advice.
So they come out really low. First thing I'm thinking of right away is the, so their angle of attack is obviously probably too much down, not delivering enough loft to it. Taking big divots, you know, I always tell people, so just because the attack angle might be way down, you know, that doesn't mean they're going to take a big divot. You could have a very, very downward attack angle. You know, you could be 10 degrees down and take no divot, because it's just the height of the arc that you're swinging on. So how high is the club off the ground? If this person's not putting a lot of spin on their wedge and they come out really low, taking big divots, number one, I would just get them to work on trying to feel like they can pick the, this would be like a drill I'd have them do. It's I call it a bit of a three ball drill. So the first ball they hit, they're literally just going to pick the ball off the turf, not even touch the turf when they strike it. So it's going to feel very picky. The second ball that they hit, and this is a skill acquisition drill that is not easy. It's tough but it will, in time, they'll learn how to control the height in which they're swinging on. The second ball, they're going to try and hit the ball, but kind of move some blades of grass, right? So not a divot, just trying to see some turf interaction where just some blades are flying around. And then the final one is where they take a divot, but it's just a normal, like a nice size divot, nothing massive. I think that person would drastically be benefited by, you know, all of a sudden getting the low point, I'll say, to happen not close to the golf ball, but just less in front of it, so that attack angle doesn't get as much down. Present a little bit more loft to it, so they can get that. But I mean, there's only one thing that gets the ball up in the air, and that's the loft of the golf club. So, and then based on whatever speed they're swinging, depends on how high it's going to go or how low it's going to go from there. But let's just say they're an average player. Well, they got plenty of speed to get the ball up in the air. but they need to allow the club to get it up in the air. So I would just, I'd really work on getting them to do that, is, you know, getting the butt, you know, you can even exaggerate, say, hey, show me one where you hit it as high as you can. Get them to change the pattern a little bit. Say you have to go over top of a tree. Well, even though the people don't know necessarily what has to happen technically, if you just tell somebody, hey, you have to go up over this tree, it's amazing how instinctively humans are athletically. Yeah. And we'll say, oh, okay, I got to go up high. All right, well, I got to do X, Y, and Z. And it's like, they don't even know what they're doing, but they're changing it.
And then obviously they're going to see the difference in the result, not only in the trajectory, but, you know, if you're measuring, obviously you can see spin rates, but you can also see the ball stopping on the green, things like that as well, right?
Totally, totally. So yeah, those are two things I'd probably say to that person would just be, start trying to hit some up in the air as high as you can, and then you can bring it down a little bit from there, but it's just a drill to get them away from being delivering not enough loft, being so much down on it. And then when it comes to those big divots, like, just feel like, start learning how to pick it up. I remember one time I watched Tiger hit balls at Bethpage Black at the US Open. And I want to say, does 2008 sound right?
Yep.
You would know. Okay. I remember watching him hit probably about, I don't know, 40 balls, I'll say, roughly, give or take, on the range. And he literally hit from the same spot the whole time. Now, I don't know.
2009, US Open? 2009.
Okay. Okay. So he literally hit from the same spot the whole time. Now, I don't know what he was hitting. Probably it looked like an 8-iron. I just by the length of the club from where I was standing. There was like literally almost no divot whatsoever. And it was pure as could be. You know, you don't need to take these massive divots to just, you know, strike it solid.
Yeah. And I guess that's the old perception that a lot of people seem to think, that, you know, if they pounded down on the golf ball and took these big divots, that for some reason it was going to make, you know, a big spin, but, you know, it was probably because of other factors more than anything.
Totally. Totally.
All right. Yeah. We'll go to the next one here. I want to be a better putter, but tend to miss a lot under 10 feet. What should I look at first, a new putter or a stroke change? Well, I know where you're probably going to go with that one.
Well, I use Sandpot Lab. So first thing I would try and see, okay, let's measure some stuff and let's see what they're currently doing. Maybe it is just the putter isn't fitted properly for their stroke at times. Probably more to it. There's probably something going on in their stroke. But again, with Sandpot Lab, like, we can measure, like, you know, what is the face doing at impact? What's the path of the putter going in? What's the rise angle of the putter into the ball? So are they hitting down on it, hitting up on it?
Yeah. So people should realize that, you know, Sandpot Lab, just like some other devices as well, it's basically a launch monitor for the putter, and you know, exactly. A lot of the same principles apply.
Exactly. It is very, very similar principles, maybe some different verbiage on how they name things, like rise angle compared to attack angle on TrackMan, but same idea. That's the first thing I would go to right away is let's get this person measured and see what's actually going on. Now, if all of a sudden, like, their strokes are really good and they have a tendency of, you know, missing it left, well, let's take a look at the lie angle of the putter, you know, so it could be just a simple adjustment in the putter. Could be. Yeah. But you don't really know until you start measuring someone up and seeing what they're actually doing. So that's the first thing I'd be doing, just get them measured.
So you're saying they just can't, you know, pixie dust, go buy a bottle of that and it's going to help their
putter automatically? I probably say don't go and spend it $500 on a new putter right away. And
without some logic to it of why you're doing
exactly.
That.
Yeah. Exactly. And again, it's, I'm always going to, my answer to that when someone says, you know, what am I doing? Like, I'm missing a lot of 5-footers. And it's like, I don't know. Let's get you measured up first. I don't know. Yeah. Like, I'm not going to take a guess.
What? You can't just give a golf tip in 15 seconds. It's going to cure everything.
I can give them some ideas as to what possibly is going on.
Right.
Yeah. But in the end, I'm not going to say for sure, definitely, that it's one of these, like, this one thing. Could be a couple of things.
Okay, on to the next one here. Best advice for a slicer. Again, you know, you could go on for an hour kind of about this, but, you know, obviously there's probably certain tendencies that happen for a person. Let's just assume they're right-handed, because obviously the highest percentage of golfers are. So best advice for a slicer.
Don't slice.
Okay. that's $150, please.
No, I'm just kidding. Number one, I obviously, if you're slicing it, for sure the path is going left. For sure that the face is open to the path. We don't know if it's open to the target or just open to the path, in which means it could technically be closed to the target, and just the path going really far left. But we definitely know that that's happening. So what do we have to do to fix that? Number one, I would definitely look at, okay, how is the club face throughout the swing? Is the face, like when you get, especially if you just go to the top of the swing and the face is like, let's say the toe of the club is hanging way down. And actually let's use a drastic example where the actual club face is angled more towards the ground compared to the sky at the top of the swing. You know, that person that has that sort of look at the top of their swing, unless they're an extremely talented golfer, I would say 99% of the time, that person's definitely not going to swing inside out to create a draw, because with that face being wide open, swinging inside out, they're just going to hit it a mile to the right. And they're going to be like, I'm not doing that. So that person is just, it comes with history, right? So when people see enough shots outdoors, especially, and they see a certain curvature, well, they're like, oh, well, it's curving off to the right. Oh, I better just aim more left. Well, all that does is just make the path go further left relative to the target line. So it's going to create a bigger slice. But they're doing that because they know that if they aim straight with the way the face is orientated, they're probably going to miss it so far right. So then, you know, it comes down to a path and a face issue, but I would always look first to see what is the face looking like throughout the swing. Is it open to the arc or is it close?
So the biggest thing here probably would be get organized in your backswing and probably early in your backswing, you know, to create the expectations later on, or otherwise you're going to be making adjustments relative to that face and that pattern, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that face is probably opening up right from the get-go, from the takeaway to the middle of the swing, to the middle of the backswing to the top of the swing. And then from there, there's no way they're going to be fixing that slice with that wide open face at the top. So again, there could be other things, but I would definitely say that would be a starting point without seeing a swing on video or measuring or whatever. That would be the first thing I would probably look at.
All right. On to number four here. I seem to hit a lot of shots off the toe on my driver. Anything I can do to help that?
Okay. So number one, I literally just had this yesterday. Where the person was consistently every time with the driver hitting it off the toe. And I let him hit probably about, I don't know, probably 7 or 8 balls.
What, was
and,
I in to see you yesterday? Or was I...
So this is, okay, there, again, it could be a couple things, but this is the most simple thing. And it's not always this way.
We're a simple show, so just give us a simple answer.
And it's not always this way. Sometimes it's just not this easy. But when he was setting up, and I wanted to see what his tendencies were. So is he going to change something, or is he just going to keep doing it? Well, he just kept doing it, and every shot was, and it wasn't just a slight toe; it was a pretty extreme toe. Well, all of a sudden, I finally stopped him. I'm like, "How about we put the club or the ball in the middle of the club face at address?" He was setting it right up off the toe to begin with. And he just kept returning to there. Now his eye, this is the tricky part, is his eye didn't realize he was putting it off the toe. He actually thought it was in the center. So when I started, you know, pushing the club putting the ball in the center of the club face by pushing the club more outwards.
He thought it was in the heel.
He's like, "That's the center?" He's like, "That looks like the heel to me." I'm like, "That's dead center." And literally one after another after that, he just found the center. I mean, there's normally more to it than that. But there's sometimes where it literally is that simple. Just check and see at address, is it there? Yeah. Then after that, I would say, no matter what a person is doing in their swing, essentially, if you're hitting it off the toe, that sweet spot is closer to you at impact than it was at address. And so sometimes it's just making people aware, like, "Hey, I got to push that sweet spot a little bit further out. I could get my hands and my arms a little further away from my body as I come into the golf ball," and just give them that sort of understanding. Because technically you should be able to, if you want to find the toe, hit the toe, find the heel, hit the heel. You want to find the center, hit the center. You're just moving the sweet spot around a little bit. And we're talking half an inch, you know. It's not.
And as you say, you know, people are very good at self-organization, so they just have to kind of be aware that they're doing it and having a willingness to sort of make changes. And I know I've seen it working with people and, you know, spraying the face or seeing the measurement on TrackMan. And, you know, sometimes they just assume they are hitting it off the center of the face. They have no idea. And I've had that situation over the years where, you know, a good player and, you know, measured her and we looked at it and all of a sudden, you know, her feeling when she hit it off the toe was that was a solid hit. And had no idea why a lot of these shots were spinning off to the right and the face was getting wide open. And, you know, really it just came down to, well, guess what? That's not really the center of the face. So you're right.
For sure.
I mean, people can self-organize a lot and they just, sometimes it's some simple things that can make a difference.
Yeah. Like my bias to myself is I'm either center to slight toe biased on my irons. And I look back and I go, no, if I push the sweet spot a little further away and I find the center, like, sure, it feels good, but I know it's a different feeling because I typically find just a little bit towards the toe side each time. But it's also probably a reason why I can only say on the golf course, I've shanked 4 balls, you know, in my life on the golf course. I'm never on the heel. I'm always towards the heel.
No, so, we've played many pro pros together and many rounds together, and I've never seen a shank from you. Thankfully.
No. It's, well, thank you.
Especially in partner events. All right. One last one here for you, and we'll let you get out of here because I know you got to get to some real work. My son is aspiring to play college golf. He's 14. How many tournaments a year should he be playing? How often should he be seeing his coach? He's an 8 and has not had a lot of formal instruction yet.
Okay. So number one, play as many tournaments as you can, but not enough where you get burnt out. That's number one. People need to understand that you still need time in between events for one, re-energizing. It takes a lot of mental strain during an event, more mentally than it does physically during a tournament. You're so focused on everything you're doing. So, but you got to be playing regularly in events. You need the experience. You need to sort of put yourself under the gun at times and get used to that feeling, because it is different than just playing a regular round of golf with your buds. So I would definitely try and get out there as much as you can, with allowing also not just time for not burning out, but time to be able to get with your coach and have some time to maybe work on some stuff that you need to have sort of lined up better and prepared for certain events. I always tell juniors, like, you know, there's times where, yes, there's events back to back to back. There's like PGA Tour. You see some guys go and they play 4 events in a row and then they're off for a couple weeks. Well, it's no different with the juniors. Like, sure, there's times where I don't see them, but they need to be able to separate their time from recovery, working on their games. All of that has to be part of it in their schedule planning and allow for that extra time. I see too many people just jam their schedules, like event here, event there, event there. Mm-hmm. And sure, they play a couple of good events and then they get into a rut and they have no time to sort of work on something to get out of it.
Recalibrate, really, more than anything.
100%. When it comes to how often should they be seeing their coach? Well, I say that, like, any of my competitive players, I pretty much see them every week to some degree. Now, again, like I just said, there's certain times where they're traveling and they're gone for 3 weeks at a time and I won't see them during that time. I'll usually still be in contact with them. I usually hear from them after either each round or after each event. And we sort of talk about what's going on and what they're struggling with or what's going really well. And so we can continue doing those things that are really well. But, you know, at 14, needing to obviously work on developing some patterns at that age, especially you said he's an 8 handicap. Yep. So, you know, there's obviously, you know, room for development there. So, you know, he needs time to obviously be spending with his coach to be able to work on those patterns, ingrain those patterns, incorporate some different ideas and some changes. So seeing a coach once every month in the summertime isn't going to cut it. You know, it's and then in the winter, like we were talking about during earlier in the podcast, is, you know, get out there as much as you can. You know, that's a great time to not have to worry about scoring and, you know, getting out there, worried about their emotions on the golf course. They literally have time to now purely develop their skills indoors. And so get in there as much as you can. And then was there one final thing you had said there?
Nope, he just had not had a lot of formal instruction. He's 8. I think that's great advice. Yeah. There. I mean, that's probably great advice for a lot of people that are developing, whether they're a junior or not, especially if they want to play competitive golf, you know, being an 8. So, you know,
and at 14 years old, like he's got, you know, 14, 15, 16 year olds are going to develop like crazy during that time frame. There's lots of growth going on in their personal self and their personal development on their bodies. So lots of things happen. Like you see, you know, some kids light it up when they're 12, 13, you know, even 14. And then they go through that growth spurt when they're 15, 14, 15, 16 time. and they struggle a little bit. You know, it's just their bodies are changing on a daily basis.
People have to remember that, you know, biological age versus chronological age can be vary by up to 5 years in teens. So people are going to, you know, it's going to vary a lot as far as that training. And that's why, you know, going to a coach like you is important, you know, because you can recognize those tendencies and how things are going on and know when to do work and when not to do work. And that's all part of the development process.
100%. I had one student, won a provincial championship and, you know, was tearing it up and had a little bit of an off year. And you look at it and he's like, well, yeah, you also grew 5 inches and you've put on like 20 pounds, like, or maybe not 20, but he definitely put on more than 10, probably 15 pounds that he put on. Like he it's crazy. So, understanding and recognizing that, and that's just one thing that no kid that I've ever been with sort of recognizes that they're not aware of that stuff. But it's something they just have to understand, like, hey, you know, this isn't necessarily just you here. Like this is you growing. You know, it's going to be okay. You're going to eventually slow down and you're going to start to be able to get a little more comfortable, a little more consistent on a daily basis with your patterns. And, but that growth is going to happen. That growth spurt is going to happen for sure with everyone.
Well, thank you, Derek. I appreciate that. I'm sure our listeners do as well. Where can people find you as far as social media and follow what you're doing?
I'm on Instagram, Derek T. McDonald. I'm on Twitter. I don't use Twitter a ton, but I follow it. Same thing, Derek T. McDonald, and on Facebook as well. Just look me up there and add me on there as well if they want.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, bud. Great advice there for a lot of people. And I'm sure a few people will be reaching out. And good luck with all your students this winter. I know we've got a lot of work to do on a few other projects that we're working on ourselves, some research and some other things, but looking forward to it.
Yeah, we're going to be busy this winter.
Yeah, it's going to be a busy one, that's for sure. So, but looking forward to it. Thanks for coming on again.
I appreciate having me. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks to Derek McDonald of the Royal Ottawa Golf Club for taking some time out of his very busy schedule to spend some time with us here on the Tee Talk podcast. Thanks as well to everyone who sent in any questions. Love receiving your feedback. Love getting your questions in. If you want any further information on the answers that Derek gave, obviously you can reach out to him on social media on his respective channels that he mentioned in the interview there. And as well, if you've got some other questions that we can use for this podcast, we'd love to hear them. We'd love to hear your feedback all the time. So leave us a review on things like Apple Podcasts, for an example, or you know what? Give us a follow on the Tee Talk podcast Instagram channel and you can send in questions there. We put out the mailbag call every week looking for questions for our guests. Otherwise, that's it. Hopefully Stefan is back next week. He's traveling safely this week and we look forward to talking to you again next week.